The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, as committed as Japan is to the Quad, they see the Quad as one of several venues through which Japan will pursue its regional interests. And you're seeing an era of fairly active Japanese diplomacy and strategic investment to counter the challenges that China presents.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 24th, 2021. The Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, more commonly known as the Quad, brings together the United States, Australia, Japan, and India in strategic dialogue on everything from disaster relief to military readiness to technology and supply chains. Today, the leaders of those four countries will meet for the first ever summit, a gathering which would have been difficult to even imagine just a few years ago. To understand what led up to this point and what could develop from it, I sat down for a fascinating conversation with three brilliant women who look at the Quad from different perspectives. Lavina Lee is a senior lecturer at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Last year, she was appointed by the Australian Minister of Defence as a director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute Council. Tanvi Madan is a senior fellow at and director of the India Project at the Brookings Institution, and she focuses in particular on India's foreign and security policies. And Sheila Smith is a senior fellow for Asia-Pacific Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a renowned expert on Japanese politics and foreign policy. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 24th, the Quad Summit, with Lavina Lee, Tanvi Madan, and Sheila Smith. Sheila, start us off here. Unfortunately, due to our scheduling difficulties, we were unable to include you in our last conversation on the Quad back in October. So first of all, welcome to the club. I'm glad we're getting the full Quad band together. But kind of bring us all up to speed on what the Quad is, why the Japanese Prime Minister, more than anybody else, was interested in pulling this coalition back together, and what the Quad had accomplished up to and through the Trump administration.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to join the band. Thank you for having me. So the Quad goes back to 2004, when the Indian Ocean tsunami was a huge humanitarian challenge for the region. And Australia, Japan, the United States, and India, of course, all had interests in trying to bring together capabilities to address the humanitarian and disaster relief efforts at the time. As a kind of diplomatic framing for regional cooperation, it's waxed and waned over time. There's been interest and then waning interest in Australia. There's been interest and then some hesitation in India. But I will say for Japan, which is the nation I know best, the Quad has always appealed for two reasons. The first is, of course, these are the four democracies of Asia, or Indo-Pacific, as we refer today. And second, it has at its core a very, not only a vast geographical area where Japan is engaged, but also an economic connectivity that the Japanese really feel ought to be the focal point of developing the region going forward. Abe Shinzo, the prime minister who resigned last year, who was in office for 8 years, was a huge advocate of the Quad as a leadership organization, that could bring an emphasis on the rule of law across this vast two oceans, three continents, and also should be able to speak out on values that the region shared. So I think the Japanese have ownership in some sense of the Indo-Pacific framing, and a particular sense that they have a role to play in encouraging the Quad collaboration.
Now, when you mentioned the framing of it, what did that framing include and what did it explicitly not include up until, let's say, last year? Sheila.
So the framing has been a little on again, off again, depending on which country you're looking at. For the Japanese, it has always been a kind of a values focus, as I said, democratic nations coming together to defend the status quo, if you will, but the rule of law, the norms of a free and open region. And so that's important to Tokyo, but also the economic instruments of statecraft. And I think this is particularly the place where the Japanese have emphasized their own role, and that is trade, investment, infrastructure building, connectivity in the broad sense of not only building roads and ports and ways in which the countries across the Indo-Pacific can come together, but also making sure that these two remain free and open and not be an exclusive region, but one that is deeply complementary to the global order.
Tanvi, when we spoke last on the podcast about this in, I believe it was October of 2020, we had seen a significant revival of the Quad, of course, during the Trump administration, but it was unclear yet that there would be a Biden administration. And then even when it was clear there would be a Biden administration, it was relatively unclear what would happen with this initiative because the campaign had shown little interest in it, certainly less than most other international issues. And I don't think there was a lot of confidence one way or another exactly how much would be invested in this institution. So tell us, what have we learned in the last several months about how the Quad fits into President Biden's desire to see the Indo-Pacific region shaping up and how the leaders of the other countries have responded in general terms?
Thanks, David. And it really is great to have the band back together. I think for the Biden administration, when it came in, it had a particular set of goals and challenges that it was facing. The president himself had made clear that given some of the challenges the democracies have been facing, particularly in terms of their image after their performance of dealing with COVID, or at least a number of democracies, including the US, that it was important to send a signal and find ways of signaling that democracies could deliver. He also wanted to emphasize alliances and partnerships. And simultaneously, they came into office, the administration, understanding, and I think once they came into office, understanding even more how much the China challenge had intensified since a number of them had been in the Obama administration. And as they thought about these, the Quad seemed to be a useful mechanism to help them with some of these objectives and approaches that they wanted to follow. So within a month of taking office, you saw the administration very quickly and speedily host a ministerial of the Quad in February. And then on March 12th, they hosted the Biden administration hosted a virtual Quad Leader Summit. This was unprecedented. There had never been a leader summit. And it was unprecedented and striking because in January, the Indian and Japanese statements on the Quad would not even use the word Quad. And so it was quite significant that the other three countries agreed to it as well. For the administration, hosting this Quad, doubling down on the Quad, fit very much and was consistent with their desire to, as I said, shore up alliances and partnerships. They'd also, their kind of strategy that they followed in those early months was to build what they called a position of strength from which to approach competitors such as China. So you saw that the Quad and a number of other meetings with bilateral and multilateral partners preceded the Alaska altercation with Chinese officials. The Quad also kind of fit into and reflected the fact that the Biden administration wanted to focus on the Indo-Pacific. They also wanted to follow a Indo-Pacific first approach from which China policy would flow. And then finally, I think they were trying to find a way to also intensify the relationship with India, which isn't an ally, but they envisioned a very core role for India within this Indo-Pacific strategy that they had. And so the Quad provided a way to work with India beyond this kind of just the bilateral dynamic. And it also fit kind of with these broader themes that the administration had, with the objective of helping ensure, as Sheila mentioned, kind of this vision that all four countries, Quad countries, have of a free, open, inclusive, and I think they've now added secure and prosperous Indo-Pacific. That is their objective. They see challenges, all four countries, to that objective, whether it's China's assertiveness, whether it's COVID, whether it's climate change. And these countries have kind of signaled that they're willing to work together. I'll just say that I think one of the reasons that the other countries and India might have been hesitant a while back to kind of elevate the Quad to the leaders level, but I suspect because of its deteriorating relationship with China, that helped it agree to this. But I think it was also a way for the others to keep the U.S. engaged, keep the Biden administration engaged in Asia. So this idea of locking in the U.S. to the region.
Right. I'd like to talk about each of the countries in turn along those lines, which is what is each leader seeking to do with this Washington summit, and what are the overarching goals coming out of it? So, Lavina, I'll turn to you first, but I think we have to do that on the background, of course, that each of the dyads within the Quad have their own cooperation and their own contacts. So Japan has its own contacts with Australia, and India has its own contacts with the United States, apart from the Quad framework, of course. But In some cases, it's especially strong. And Lavina, of course, I'm looking to you to talk about the Australia-U.S. relationship, because we're just coming off, less than a week ago, I believe, the Australia-U.S. ministerial consultations between the Secretary of State and Defense on the U.S. side and the Minister for Foreign Affairs and Minister for Defense on the Australian side. And it struck me that the joint statement coming out of that, the first main section they talked about was Indo-Pacific cooperation. And within that, they alluded to things like the COVID-19 vaccine production and delivery assistance program. They talked about the Mekong subregion. They talked about ASEAN. They talked about Myanmar. They talked about a whole bunch of issues. But the very first item in that very first section was the Quad. So put some perspective on that for us. How does Australia see the Quad as it has shaped up to now? And what is it that the Prime Minister probably seeks to do at this summit and have coming out of it?
First of all, thanks again for having me on the podcast. Look, the last week has been a really quite a momentous week for Australia. I think the Quad meeting this week is a bit overshadowed by the AUKUS announcement.
Oh, don't worry. We will be getting to that specifically later. But yes, that certainly feeds into the context here, doesn't it?
Definitely. So, you know, last week we did also have the AUSMIN consultations, 2+2, that happens every year. And all that you've said is correct. They do have a long list of kind of statements, joint statements about all sorts of issues. But I think for me, what AUSMIN really represents this year is a progression of our doubling down on the US alliance. So you can see within that AUSMIN statement that Australia is really wanting and is willing for the United States to really utilise Australia more and to integrate our force posture with the United States even more than we have before. So if you look at the joint statement, it's talking about an openness to more rotations of troops in our Northern Territory. Already we have 2,500 Marines that rotate through the Northern Territory every year on a 6-monthly basis. Mm-hmm. But our Defence Minister is talking about wanting more troops to come and rotate, about forward deployments of munitions, more exercises between Australia and the United States. So I think what you should get out of AUSMIN this year is that there is no doubt that Australia is choosing the United States and that it sees that our alliance with the United States actually gives us more options. But beyond our bilateral relationship, Australia views the Quad as primarily an integral way of bringing India into the conversation. So Australia and Japan are allies of the United States. We already work very closely with Japan and the United States on all sorts of issues. But the Quad gives us a means of drawing in India. And if we're really talking about a new geostrategic construct, which is the Indo-Pacific doesn't work unless India is part of it. And I think in our Quad relationship, our weakest relationship is with India, but that is improving, and the Quad structure actually helps us even more to improve that bilateral relationship and to broaden it beyond military issues, but to also include things like technology, supply chains, tech development standards, cooperation on COVID vaccines, renewable energy technologies, etc.
Sure. One follow-up for you. You mentioned the presence of the U.S. Marines, I believe, primarily in the northern area. That's primarily in and around Darwin, am I correct?
Yes, that's right.
What is the perception there? Have you heard anything from reactions from what was effectively zero presence there, 10 years ago, to now a relatively substantial and growing American presence there? How is that going?
Well, look, I think the kind of dissenting voices are growing smaller. And I think that's actually largely because of the way China has been treating Australia, to be frank, over the last year. So, you know, admittedly, Australia has been taking some very forward-leaning positions to counter or oppose Chinese policies over the last 4 or 5 years. So we were one of the first countries to support the Permanent Court of Arbitration ruling in 2016 and call it legally binding from the beginning. We've introduced foreign interference legislation that the Chinese government didn't like very much and that other countries are now seeking to emulate. We've also, in the last year, I think this is what probably triggered everything, was that we called for a investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. And almost within days or almost immediately, our Chinese embassy here, China's embassy in Australia, issued effectively a coercive threat against various sectors of our exports to China. And over the course of 2020, they made good on those threats. So Australia's lost about $20 billion of exports to China, and this is included beef, barley, wine, coal exports were prevented from docking into Chinese ports. So it's really the deterioration of our relationship with China has accelerated over the last year. And the Australian government hasn't backed down on that. So we're standing firm. And I think doubling down on our alliance, broadening our participation in the Quad is part of our strategy to deter and shape Chinese behavior going forward.
If I can read between the lines, what I hear you saying is that United States Marines are helping to make up for the loss of exports of beef and wine to China by their amazing consumption of the same in the North.
No, I think, further to your question earlier, I think the Australian public has been particularly affected by that economic coercive campaign.
Right.
So whatever doubts that there might have been about whether our strategy is causing that deterioration, I think there's a greater understanding that, especially you may have heard of the issuing of a list of 14 grievances by the Chinese embassy in Australia, and they include all of the things that I've mentioned in terms of Australian policy. And I think most of them are about Australian domestic policy. So from Australia's perspective, these are sovereign decisions that we make about how we run our own country. And I think in terms of public opinion, this has really galvanized the public to see the Chinese Communist Party in a different light.
Okay. Sheila, from the Japanese perspective, what do you expect that the Prime Minister wants out of this summit meeting, either in terms of substance or in terms of optics? And what will the Japanese political elite and public be looking for?
So I think that, you know, because Prime Minister Abe Shinzo laid out this free and open Indo-Pacific vision, as both Tambi and Lavina pointed out, this is a moment of real confidence, I think, for Japan. Now, we have a different prime minister. We can talk about this later, but he's coming to Washington, of course, at a time when his successor is about to be elected in Japan. So politically, he's not on the same, you know, the same position as Abe was when he was thinking and talking to partners in the Quad. But I think Japan is very clear about its ambitions in the Quad. One is, I think Tambi mentioned this earlier, is to make sure to anchor the United States in this coalition. And two is to build an agenda of cooperation that's not just for today or tomorrow, but that is sustainable and allows these four countries to move forward on key areas of cooperation. So I think the Japanese are quite happy that the United States has initiated this leaders setting to do that. I think the Japanese are also quite interested in making sure that the Quad is one of many frameworks within the Indo-Pacific that Japan can center its own ambitions and its own ability to shape the region. And this is not just necessarily containing China, but again, to go back to the, you know, sustaining the rules of the road, so to speak, but also deepening the strategic cooperation that Japan has begun in a trilateral setting in some cases, first with Australia and the United States, and then with United States and India. Now Japan is much freer to pursue strategic cooperation with New Delhi, with Canberra on its own in this framing, this you know, quadrilateral framing of shared goals for the region. So you may understand Japan's ambition of being just about Japan, but Japan is very anxious to make sure that the Indo-Pacific region remains an open and free arena for commerce, for trade, for investment, for prosperity, including the infrastructure building and investment there. But I think this is for Japan, I think one of their primary goals. You know, Japan has depended on this region for its security and prosperity in the post-war era, and they see China as beginning to erode some of the values that it has, you know, Japan has lived by. So this is a little bit of an existential challenge for Japan and a commitment by Japan to these networks of cooperation. And the Quad is first and foremost in its mind, I think, these days in terms of how to make sure that the region continues to move forward together. Can I say one thing, David? I think it's really important when we talk about the Quad also, and this is important in Tokyo. It's often in the news or the commentary these days that the Quad is attempting to replace the ASEAN or the ASEAN-centric multilateral institutions of the region. And here, Tokyo is quite sensitive to making sure that this is not perceived as an Indo-Pacific NATO or as an Asian NATO. But rather, it's a way to complement the larger goals of building multilateralism across the region in a way that will sustain prosperity and obviously security. So I think you see Japan also keeping a foot in this idea that the ASEAN countries, the Southeast Asian countries, also have to have a bridge in the agenda that the Quad is building. And the diplomats are working quite hard in Tokyo and around the region to make sure and to reassure the ASEAN countries that this is not an attempt to replace ASEAN or to overshadow the interests of the Southeast Asian nations, but rather to bring capabilities and the capacity to deliver on these capabilities, right, to the fore in ways that the ASEAN countries really can't.
Sure.
So, you know, as committed as Japan is to the Quad, they see the Quad as one of several venues through which Japan will pursue its regional interests. And you're seeing an era of fairly active Japanese diplomacy and strategic investment to counter the challenges that China presents.
Thank you. Tanvi, to you for the Indian perspective, what is it that Modi is seeking to get from this visit and this first, for many people, frankly, the first high-profile view they're going to get of the Quad as an institution? What about the Indian angle on this?
I think, you know, as I was listening to Lavina and Sheila speak, I was struck by how much overlap there is in terms of how India sees both the Quad, but also the objectives that the Quad should be pursuing, the fact that it is embedded even for India within kind of a lot of other coalitions, bilateral relationships, trilaterals, participation and cooperation with ASEAN. And I think it is because there is so much overlap today that you've seen the Quad sustain. This has been very much a work in progress. And I think you've seen it evolve step by step. The countries have had a better understanding of each other's interests, approaches, and got to a point where I think the vision they share and the approach they share, including in terms of how to ensure that ASEAN is reassured, is quite similar. I think from India's perspective, it is the Quad helps it achieve several objectives. It's also reflective of, I'd say, four or five things in Indian foreign policy today. I think one is, and while we will not hear the C word, China, mentioned explicitly, the Quad for India in particular, but I suspect for some of the other Quad members as well, the Quad would not have been necessary or possible without concern in India about Chinese assertiveness
right.
in the region, particularly vis-a-vis China, but also the recognition in India that India cannot tackle this China challenge on its own. And the China challenge is not just about the ongoing boundary crisis. The two countries are still involved in a face-off. But that they, for India, from India's perspective, it just has a fundamentally different vision of the region from China. And the India's belief is that China wants a unipolar Asia dominated by China, and what India would like to see is a multipolar Asia. And the Quad is a mechanism, one of the mechanisms through which India can work with other like-minded partners to ensure that that multipolar Asia exists, where, as Sheila said, rules prevail, and where, you know, might does not force its way through a number of different avenues and get its way. There's another kind of a few aspects the Quad reflects for India. I think it reflects a fundamentally different vision of Indian perception of American power and presence in the region than India had in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. At that time, India used to think of American power and presence in the region as a problem. Today, it thinks about that as part of the solution in the region, if not essential. And so this goes back to the anchoring reason. And then I think, you know, the Quad would not exist for India today if it wasn't for a transformed, India's had a close relationship with Japan for a number of years. But as Lavina said, the weakest link of the Quad, the weakest dyad of the Quad was India-Australia. And that has really transformed in the last few years, more so than any other Indian relationship. It's transformed for the better, particularly on the defense and security side. And it is driven in part, not entirely, but in large part by a convergence on China. And so I think what India is looking for this Quad summit, and I think it's important to remember, this is not a US-led grouping. So these leaders do not come to the to kind of Washington thinking about getting something particular out of the US. This is something they've developed together. Worked on together.
Right.
These initiatives that you will hear about are collaborative. And so I think what India will be looking for is a sense of, you know, forward momentum on a number of these different issues and wanting to see the Quad deliver and play its own part in doing this, deliver practical solutions to regional problems so that they can show the region, which worries about the China aspects of this in particular, that the Quad is a grouping of like-minded countries that isn't the, you know, anti-China exclusive security club that Beijing says it is, but it can actually be useful to them as well. So I think for India, the Quad, so kind of the gist of it is, India would like to see the Quad and wants to contribute via the Quad to building a balancing coalition in the region, which it'll talk less about publicly. But also it sees the Quad as useful to help work with these other countries and help build resilience in the region, which isn't just about Australia, India, Japan, and the US's capabilities, but particularly in terms of how they can build resilience in the region amongst non-member states across a variety of domains, health, climate, education, as well as technology, economics, politics, political systems, and then security as well, though that is usually not what they emphasize in the Quad setting.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Lavina, let me ask you to follow up on one part of that, which is the security dimension, because the Quad, as it originally came out of tsunami relief, and it's emphasized things like reaction to COVID, and that is a large part of the institutional dialogues. We have to be honest that there is a China dimension that is as yet unnamed, and the four navies and their special forces are, you know, conducting military exercises in a way that could not have been imagined in the same way 5 or 10 years ago. And Australia has obviously been crucial to that. But it also intersects with the effort that you previewed earlier, which is the effort to solidify the relationship with the United Kingdom and the United States in the new agreement and the acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines, albeit to the displeasure of Paris. So bring those things together for us and talk about what the combination of the agreement with the United States and the United Kingdom and the willingness to participate in these quadrilateral military exercises with the rest of the Quad countries says about how Australia is thinking about military and security threats in both the Indian and the Pacific theaters.
Look, I think if you look at the trajectory of Australia's, I guess, relationship with the United States, with India and Japan bilaterally, and then via the Quad, you know, our threat perceptions of China have just magnified over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the submarine issue, so AUKUS, the big headline was the acquisition of, by 2040, so we've still got a long way to go, of 8 nuclear-powered but conventionally armed submarines. And in order to do that, they also had to break in an agreement with France to provide conventionally powered submarines. So that's created a whole diplomatic problem for Australia. But I think, you know, we think that our security situation is really deteriorating, and the French contract was only going to be able to provide us with submarines that were probably substandard, but the designs, the costs overruns, this has been going on for more than 2 or 3 years. So when the French appear to be outraged, they talk about treason and being stabbed in the back. It's really actually from our domestic perspective, there's been so many problems with these deals, and there's a number of gateways in the contract, and the French were very much aware that their delivery was wanting. So I think there's a bit of a performance going on, but what you can say about the AUKUS deal is that it really represents, for me, that the United States too understands that the situation is deteriorating and that they really wanted Australia to add to the submarine deterrent, and that they need their allies and partners to step up, and Australia is willing to play that role. I think a less emphasized aspect of this deal is that it's likely that Australia will lease submarines between now and 2040 as in nuclear-powered submarines from the United States and the United Kingdom, because we need to deploy them much sooner than 2040. And that there's all sorts of other military-industrial aspects to this deal, that finally Australia and the United Kingdom will be brought in within the US National Technology Industrial Base, which they had been included in I think, in the last couple of years, but the regulatory hurdles had not been cleared. So now we can see that there's going to be a much greater integration between those three countries in terms of their cooperation and collaboration on things like cyber, artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, undersea capabilities, and also their integration of their supply chains. Australia is also going to be buying a lot of equipment from the United States that is going to really improve their ability to contribute to long-range strike capabilities across the Indo-Pacific. So we're talking about things like Tomahawk cruise missiles, long-range anti-ship missiles, but also collaboration on hypersonic missiles. So I think, you know, what Australia is trying to do is, one, to more closely integrate our force posture with the United States, to be able to assist the United States to remain in the Indo-Pacific and be a potent balancing force, so to be a force multiplier for the United States, but to contribute in our own right. And I think going back to that idea of the weaknesses between Australia and India, one of the issues that Australia's always had is that India has often viewed Australia as not bringing enough to the table, that if you're going to, initially when India was thinking about reconstituting the Quad, Australia was really strongly pushing it. I would often hear the comment, well, what does Australia add? Why should we antagonise China when we can continue our strong relationships with Japan and the United States and achieve a lot of our purposes? And I think what Australia is doing is really putting to bed a lot of those doubts about what Australia brings to the table within the Quad, in that we are not only a Pacific power, but an Indian Ocean power. So for India, Australia becoming more capable in the Indian Ocean is a good thing for India and their concerns about Chinese encroachment into the Indian Ocean. And I think in the future, we'll see Australia and Japan really trying to push India to play a greater role in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific.
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by one of those aspects in particular that you brought up, and I'd like to get Sheila and Tanvi to weigh in on this as well, which is the supply chain, the technology side of things, because frankly, many of us are biased to look at this as a geopolitical issue vis-a-vis China, or to look at this in terms of military exercises, or frankly, to look at this in terms of COVID vaccine deliveries. But one of the more interesting aspects, and even developing just yesterday, is the issue of technology and education and cyber issues coming up. We do know from a draft joint statement that has been obtained by some media sources that they are planning on talking extensively about technological development and supply chains that are vital to shared national interests, which makes sense given that the US and Japan account for roughly 30% of the world's chip making capacity, and India has such a thriving IT industry but is heavily reliant on China for chips. So you put all this together along with Australia's role, and you have a natural place for this discussion of supply chains in the computer and technology world. But the fact that this could even venture into cyber and space issues, which Japan more historically, India more recently, have been expanding in. Sheila, what do you see as kind of is there even a ceiling for the kinds of cooperation that could happen within the Quad framework on this wider set of issues than those core security elements that we tend to look at?
So this is what I'm looking forward to seeing come out of tomorrow's meeting, because, you know, this whole question of resilience, and this is something that was brought up in the February meeting in the virtual summit, and it runs the gamut of, as you noted, questions about supply chain vulnerabilities versus the way in which Beijing has been imposing economic coercion. The Australian case, of course, and the tariffs imposed on Australia has really left, I think, a pretty indelible impression on these four countries, the four Quad countries, that, you know, basically believe that economic interdependence with China was a good, you know, had a good outcome for everybody. So I think what you're starting to see is this idea that these four countries in particular, but I would extend it to Europe and others as well, but that we need to start thinking a little bit more carefully about our resilience, our ability to deal with regular, you know, frameworks of economic commerce. So that's supply chains, but also crisis responses, such as responses to the pandemic. So I think you're seeing a really interesting conversation emerge here, not just about the four countries of the Quad, but this question of, you know, without jumping to the conclusion that we are decoupling from China, right? But rather right. Something short of that, where do we see benefit in diversification of our major focal points of connectivity? Again, supply chains. I would say defense technology innovation is another place. I would say clearly cyber is another space. And I think that you mentioned space, and I think that's going to be an interesting place to also to see the way that these four countries come together. So I think it's an appreciation of the need to shore up the resilience that all four of our countries would like to continue to enjoy, while recognizing that there are some particular areas that both have economic strategic implications, but also potentially military ones as well. Let me just say a couple words about Japan's experience with this. Is, of course, during the crisis, this is almost a decade old now, but a crisis with China over the islands in the East China Sea. This is what the Japanese call Senkaku and the Chinese referred to as Jiaoyu. So this was a territorial sovereignty, you know, spat. Mm-hmm. But in the midst of that, Beijing slowed its customs processing of rare earth minerals, right? Materials, really sort of flummoxing Japanese manufacturing of all kinds of things. And it wasn't until that moment that the Japanese really felt that China would play that card. In other words, would use economic integration as a source of political, right, strength in a crisis. And I think you start to see attitudes in Tokyo shift about, well, how much should we be completely open to economic integration with China? To what degree should we, you know, gather with the United States and Europe in the case of rare earths, of course, in sort of urging China to think about fair and equitable trade? And so that's the first time you start to see the Japanese take on seriously the WTO complaint right. that the United States and Europe had launched against China. So I think, you know, you move it today, you know, fast forward a decade or more, and I think the Japanese are much, much more concerned about their supply chain vulnerability. And they're much, much more focused on issues, particularly in semiconductors, right? Where Taiwan plays a significant role mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. supply of semiconductors to Japan. We're also seeing the way in which, you know, China-Taiwan tensions are affecting the Japanese consideration of this question of resilience. So in the Quad, I think it's going to be very interesting to see exactly what issues will come under this rubric of collective action, if you will, on resilience. And to what extent is it broad-based trade liberalization, right? And to what extent is it more strategic issues, such as you noted, the space and cyber domains? So I think this is a really interesting space to watch the Quad. I wouldn't say that my expectation is fully on the Quad to move this conversation forward, but I think it's a very interesting venue for these four countries to explore in terms of what they're able and willing to do together to enhance their mutual resilience.
Right. Tanvi, same issue in terms of the, I'll put it in terms of the overall issue, the overall technology part of the Quad dialogue now elevating to the level of the heads of state of the countries, the heads of government. What do you see being both the Indian angle on this from the IT sector, but then overall for the evolution of the Quad, expanding into areas like cybersecurity, like space issues? How do you envision this playing out?
So, you know, I like the way you framed it in terms of what is the ceiling. And I don't think there necessarily is one, and that's one of the strengths, I think, of keeping the Quad as a fairly flexible institution. You know, there have been some who've called for this to be formalized in a very traditional way, headquarters, entire kind of offices, etc. They haven't done that, but there is some institutionalization. And along with that, there has been exploration of these new territories to think about. I mean, territories in terms of issue areas, to think about how these four countries can work together. And I think in some cases, you know, they discuss issues and it turns out that this is not the best platform for them because they're not the relevant countries. Goes to what Sheila was saying, that it can't be just these countries on a variety of technological issues. I think this does, though, bring together four countries. And this is where, from India's perspective, you know, it can, on a variety of technology fronts, not just IT, where obviously it's had strengths traditionally. But even if you think about kind of the more advanced technology domains, cyber and space, quantum computing, AI, this is where India can benefit from a security perspective, a political economy perspective, from a jobs perspective, as well as a skilling perspective. It can benefit from work with the other Quad countries in this, but it can also bring a fair amount to the table. India, I think, it's often forgotten, has a pretty advanced space program. I think people might remember there was kind of a Mars rover that India put up in space for less than the price of the movie Gravity. So this is areas where I think India can bring something to the table, and it can also learn from the other countries. And I think one thing that the Quad can help do is also be one of the platforms where the conversations around norms and standards in these technology questions come up. So not just the kind of development of the technology per se, but also the norms and standards. But I think, you know, what Sheila said is important. This is not necessarily the right platform for every discussion about technology or every discussion about, frankly, all sorts of issues. The technology conversations, for example, will have to involve a conversation with Europe, for example. It will have to involve a conversation with the UK. And so I think, you know, one of the things that I suspect the Quad will be doing, and we'll see more of this in the joint statement, is which particular areas within the broader technology framing they've figured out makes sense to talk about in the Quad format versus others that the US might decide or one of the other countries might decide they actually want to have that conversation with a different set of actors, with a different coalition, because that's the coalition that is most relevant to those issues. I will say one thing from India's perspective, which is related to technology and AUKUS. I absolutely agree, because it is related to bringing in the EU or Europeans and the Brits into these kind of broader conversations. I absolutely agree that India will be broadly supportive of AUKUS for the reasons laid out. It will increase American and Australian capability and kind of convey their commitment to the Indo-Pacific in a way that few other things can. And India wants to see, you know, this will also kind of increase cumulative Quad capability in the region, helps to add to the deterrence vis-a-vis China. But I do think, you know, I mean, not just because France is a very close partner of India's, which is why it has not come out and endorsed AUKUS. I think what India will worry about is whether these hurt feelings will translate into. I don't think it worries that France will do less in the Indo-Pacific. France wasn't doing things in the Indo-Pacific for American interests or Australian interests. It was doing it because France is a resident power that has its own interests there. I think where India will worry about, will this kind of damage or stall or slow down cooperation is on things like technology. Is, for example, you know, the EU-US Trade and Technology Council was supposed to meet. And next week, that has been postponed. And so I think it is in those kind of things that India would like to see all these coalitions of like-minded states that are working on different issues. Technology is a good example, to be moving in the same direction, even if not at the same pace. And so I think, you know, you're going to see these conversations take place across different bilaterals, different coalitions. But I think we've also seen in the last couple of weeks that these are coalition management is a high maintenance endeavor, and it needs to be handled with care. Otherwise, it starts spilling over into, for example, even what the Quad would like to see happen.
Lavina, you get the closing thoughts here tonight, and we'll resume the conversation, I am sure, not too long from now. But for tonight, I'm in particular curious about your take on how the Chinese will respond to this, because this is different. This is something that the Quad countries have resisted to this point. It was inconceivable just a few years ago that this would become something with a summit meeting of the leaders of this very loose and decidedly not alliance-like institution called the Quad. And suddenly, in the wake of the submarine deal and the announcement of wider cooperation and joint military exercises and joint cooperation on technology transfer and illicit technology acquisition fronts, China certainly sees a target on it from this development and this summit. So from the Australian perspective, since you brought up China and the issues in the Chinese-Australian relationship in recent years, how do you see the Chinese reaction to this summit? And in turn, how do you see the Australians either playing against that or building on that in their efforts for strategic security?
Honestly, Beijing responds very predictably to all of these developments. So it's gone from when the Quad first reconstituted in 2017 to describing it in very derogatory and dismissive types of terms, and then over time continually refers to things like a Cold War mentality, Asian NATO, those kinds of things. But I think, you know, it's clear that there are all of these overlapping institutions, newly formed institutions that are being created. So the Quad is just one of them, and as Sheila and Tanvi have made clear too, that there is now AUKUS, there's the Quad, there are various Quad Plus mechanisms, all I think based on a common perception that China under President Xi is a very different beast, and that the challenge to the rules-based order is persistent, it's comprehensive, it goes beyond military functions as we've talked about. It's a comprehensive challenge that covers a range of areas. I guess all of these institutions are broadly complementary, but things like the Quad really deal with that comprehensive challenge to China's determination to set things like regional discourse, to promote its own authoritarian norms and values, to dominate the technologies of the future, and to create a hierarchical economic order with the Middle Kingdom at the centre. So I think Beijing may bluster, but ultimately it has to, well, I would hope that its leaders start to think about whether it used to bide its time and hide its brightness. And that was a technique to avoid countervailing coalitions building against it. And now it no longer hides its brightness. It has a much more overtly coercive, aggressive approach to many countries that oppose various policies. And this has resulted in what they didn't want to happen, countervailing coalitions building, to attempt to shape and defend, or shape Chinese action going forward, but also to defend the rules and norms that have made a large number of countries very prosperous.
And I will press pause there because I'm sure we will resume this again soon. Sheila, Tanvi, Lavina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please rate the podcast and use your social media to spread the word about the Lawfare Podcast. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha Howell. Hamza Chatou of Goat Rodeo Studios is our audio engineer. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.